Hey, DC, did you know that it's Arbor Week? And that means it's the perfect time to learn about and protect our trees. Local nonprofit Casey Trees is helping to protect our tree canopy by teaching kids the value of trees and working with them to plant new ones. The trees they're planting now ensure that future Washingtonians have a beautiful and healthy city. So support Casey Trees today by giving online at caseytrees.org/give. Your tax-deductible donation will go directly toward tree planting efforts in historically underserved communities, including schools in Wards 5, 7, and 8. Once again, that's caseytrees.org/give. Let's plant some trees, y'all!
Today on CityCast DC, DC Attorney General Carl Racine has delivered yet another blow to Dan and Tanya Snyder as they apparently prepare to sell the Washington Commanders. I'm here with sports journalist Kevin Blackstone and our pal, Greater Washington's Dan Reed, to talk about how the latest investigation details could affect the Commanders' sale. And we're also talking election results in Maryland and Virginia and about a wonky DC policy about sidewalks. Today is Friday, November 11th, 2022. I'm Michael Schaefer, and this is CityCast DC. So we will get to Snyder in a second, which I feel like is the actual motto of the Washington, D.C. media for the last 22 years. We'll get to Snyder in a second. That's the juicy stuff. But let's talk first about the bigger picture, which is there was an election Tuesday, as you may recall, and it's still going on in some places, but those places don't include Maryland and Virginia. And we talked about D.C. a bit yesterday. So let's talk about what happened in the suburbs. Dan, you are, in fact, are you still a Silver Spring resident?
That's right. I live in Silver Spring, so though I joke I can see D.C. from my house.
Well, you will soon be able to see D.C. from your house through a haze of cannabis smoke because weed, recreational use of cannabis, marijuana, was legalized in a referendum on Tuesday.
That's right. And I think the surprising thing about it is it happened with so little noise. I don't remember seeing any ads for or against it or any yard signs or anything like that. It seemed like a much bigger deal when the state legalized medical marijuana a few years ago.
Even though a vastly smaller number of people will have to jump through a vastly greater number of hoops to take advantage of that.
Exactly. It's as if people have decided to give up about fighting weed. It's here. It's normal now. You smell it everywhere in Maryland already.
Okay,
even though it's not legal yet.
But practically speaking, you should not take out a lease on a storefront to operate a weed business quite yet, because they actually haven't said or developed any sort of framework for how they're going to whether there will be like stores you can walk into and buy. The only thing that's changed is it is no longer a crime to carry up to 1.5 ounces. There's no framework for how to sell it, et cetera. It'll be a little, for a time at least, like in DC, where there's sort of weird loophole-y things. Is there an expectation that they're now going to get into the nitty-gritty of how to like regulate stores?
I think that's the next question, right? So the law that's been passed, come July 1st, you'll be able to hold weed, you'll be able to grow up to two plants in your house, but you won't be able to buy or sell it yet. And so that's the next conversation, is figuring out how that'll actually work, because it is still illegal at the federal level, which complicates this a lot.
Right, right. But listen, you are an urbanist. I'm going to throw a curveball here to you. When I was in California, it seemed like every other store was a weed store. What is the potential of this to do to, you know, neighborhoods like yours, or to do to neighborhoods where retail has suffered because people are buying most of their stuff on Amazon now, et cetera? Is there any sense of what this might mean?
You know, this is kind of an interesting opportunity because a lot of retail stores closed during the pandemic. And so there are a lot of vacancies. There are certainly a fair number of vacant stores here in Silver Spring. And when medical marijuana was legalized, there were restrictions on how many dispensaries you could have in a given area, right? There were two dispensaries in my neighborhood here in Silver Spring, one of which is like at the end of my street. I imagine in a scenario in which you were allowed to operate a storefront that sold or distributed weed in some form, there are certainly folks who are going to take advantage of the opportunity, and that could be a chance to fill some vacant storefronts that exist now. You know, one of the conversations that is happening around legal weed in Maryland is how can we ensure that, in particular, Black-owned entrepreneurs and businesses get to benefit from this? Because historically, you know, it is Black people who disproportionately are the greatest number of weed-related arrests, right?
Right. And those arrests are going to be expunged. The records are going to be expunged for when it was a possession-only arrest in the past.
That's right.
Also in Maryland, Wes Moore. It's going to be interesting because the outgoing governor of Maryland has been a subject of a lot of will he run for president kind of talk. And the incoming governor, I suspect, will quite soon become subject of that kind of talk because he's this incredible, inspiring figure.
Yeah, I already saw a tweet about it yesterday. He is a really inspiring, handsome, charismatic person. I've met him exactly once, and he's one of those politicians where he clasps your hand in both hands and he looks in your eyes like he can see into your soul. And people eat that stuff up, right? It's also interesting because not only is he the first Black governor in Maryland history and also the head of an administration with the first non-white lieutenant governor and the first Black attorney general, he's also one of the youngest governors in the country right now. The youngest governor will be Sarah Huckabee Sanders in Arkansas. She's 40, then Wes Moore, and then Ron DeSantis, who, if you had told me he was 44, I would not have believed you. But these are also names that are sort of considered rising stars in their respective parties, and it sounds like Wes Moore might be joining them.
That's right. And we're in the region going to have, with Youngkin as well. I mean, this is a region not for a couple hundred years has it been a cradle of presidents, but it'll be the subject of a lot of that conversation, I think.
Oh, absolutely. I think we'll get a lot of attention in 24 about this.
So Moore won pretty convincingly, won by like 20, 25 points. The outgoing governor, Republican Hogan, declined to endorse the Republican candidate, who was a far-right, election-denying Trump figure. But if you look at a map of Maryland, I mean, it's just kind of striking. The rural portions of the state still are red. The Eastern Shore, the Southern counties, Western Maryland.
Yeah. You know, Maryland's slogan is America in miniature. And if you look at an electoral map, it reads, right? I think what is interesting, though, is the Democrats kind of took a gamble on the primaries. They spent money on ads for Dan Cox in the hopes that he would win the primary and he would be so extreme that he would, in fact, throw it to Wes Moore, which worked, right? Part of Larry Hogan's appeal is that he could cross political boundaries, right? You know, Larry Hogan got more votes in Montgomery County than the entire Eastern Shore. And that's part of why he won twice.
Right, right. So meanwhile, on the other side of the Potomac, boy, there was a lot of TV ads and a couple of these Northern Virginia races in districts that had become Democratic held in the last half decade or so. In Northern Virginia, both of the endangered or targeted Democrats held, notably Abigail Spanberger, who represents a swath of the state that includes like a lot of Prince William County. What happened there?
It's a really interesting case, right? So the district was redistricted. Abigail Spanberger used to represent a district that was mostly like the middle part of the state and areas west of Richmond. And in fact, her predecessor was Dave Bratt, who was one of like Tea Party Republicans who swept in the 2010s. And her new district includes like a little bitty chunk of Northern Virginia, Prince William County, Spotsylvania County, Frederick, which are a teeny bit more liberal. So I think that gave her an advantage, but there's another story there, which is a sort of growing Latino vote, right? Particularly in Prince William County, where Yesley Vega, her opponent, was a county supervisor. And it's the similar sort of story we've seen in other parts of the country, where the Republican Party has done a lot of outreach to Latino voters. Governor Youngkin did that a lot last year. Sometimes Democrats have taken it for granted. They prevailed this time, but I think it should be a warning for the future that they should not take, especially in a region as diverse as Northern Virginia, the votes of Latino and other immigrant communities for granted.
Yeah, I think the other thing cooking is, you know, Virginia is a really, I mean, the right is pretty far right. And the left, which is basically a lot of Northern Virginia, represents a you know, a kind of blue place, which is to say a lot of those neighborhoods are pretty rich. So these are not places to like where you're going to like line them up against the wall, line the capitalists against the wall or something. But they're places with pretty tolerant cultural values, et cetera. And so that the divide, you know, with the candidate running against Spanberger, Yesli Bega, being in favor of, you know, no exception abortion bans, stuff like that, that degree of difference is pretty striking.
Yeah, it is the kind of comment that has brought down other Republicans and races over the past several years. And it that also, I think, helped really decide things for Abigail Spanberger. Like that quote taken out and put in campaign ads I saw every single morning for the past like 3 months watching the morning news to the point where I could probably recite it in my sleep.
Yeah. One of the things you probably didn't hear about if you were watching like CNN or something for election returns was the Arlington County Council. But, you know, actually, I think there was an issue there in the election that Matt DiFerranti won about missing middle housing, which was actually so evocative of where the country's at right now. The question is basically your favorite subject. Are you going to upzone some of the residential neighborhoods so you can put up small multi-unit housing in it? Ultimately, the candidate who was sort of in the middle on that pulled through. What do you make of that?
Right. You know, in Arlington, similar to other parts of the region, there's been much ado about duplexes the past couple of years. The county has been looking at a proposal that would basically allow between up to two and up to eight homes on lots where you can only build a single family house now. It has been a lot of conversation. And Matt DiFerranti, who was the incumbent county board member, was trying to take the middle position. He supported the missing middle proposal, but not as far as eight units per lot. Audrey Clement, his opponent, was strongly opposed to any kind of zoning changes, and she got a lot of support in the sort of wealthier northern parts of the county. And then you had a third candidate who was explicitly in support of upzoning and even more, who got a very small portion of the vote. It wasn't totally a referendum on missing middle. You know, county board elections are nonpartisan, so there's a whole lot of other things at play. But I think for supporters of more housing in Arlington, this might be viewed as a mandate for it's time to allow missing middle housing.
In DC, meanwhile, you know, we talked yesterday about the local election here, but the national election, because of the weird status of DC, has an impact on how we live our lives here. What kind of impact that'll be is up for grabs. But the super close, you know, even if we assume the Republicans do get a majority, I can't tell if that tightness of it'll be good news or bad news for DC.
I think it's going to be great news for apartment landlords and Navy Yard.
How so? So
the stereotype is that's where a lot of the Trump staffers and right-wing congressional staffers like to live because it's close to the Hill and it's new. I'm curious if there is divided government between the House and the Senate, if it will make that much of a change for DC.
I just mean if there's like a very close split in the House and McCarthy doesn't have as much control over his caucus because any one or two members could bring everything crashing down, something that's kind of easy for him to toss to the far right is like, oh, sure, like let's put in a measure to say, you know, all communists have to register before going to the bathroom in Washington, D.C., or you know, something like that. Historically, unfortunately, it's been a thing that Democrats have kind of been willing to give on because it's easier to give that to the crazies as they see it than to give something of, you know, of national substance. So it could be like a perverse thing that the Republican lack of success winds up making things more excruciating on the home rule question.
I think that is a common theme, is regardless of the majority that Republicans get, they're clearly out for blood before the election and now especially after the election with their disappointing results.
Hey, DC art lovers, award-winning actress and playwright Anna Deavere Smith is giving a four-part lecture series at the National Gallery of Art. It is called Chasing That Which Is Not Me / Chasing That Which Is Me. Smith is known for her roles in The West Wing, Inventing Anna, and Nurse Jackie, so you definitely want to come take a listen. They'll be every Sunday from April 28th to May 19th at 2 p.m. And the best part is they are totally free! Register to secure your spot at nga.gov/melon24.
All right, so let's talk about the Commanders. Kevin Blackstone is here to talk with us. How you doing?
Great. How about you?
Good. Thank you for coming. D.C. Attorney General Carl Racine is filing a consumer protection lawsuit against the Washington Commanders, Daniel Snyder, the NFL, and Commissioner Roger Goodell. He says those four entities colluded to deceive D.C. residents about the sexual harassment non-investigation into the team last year.
The evidence shows Mr. Snyder was not only aware of the toxic culture within his organization, he encouraged it and he participated in it. With this lawsuit, we're standing up for D.C. residents who were repeatedly lied to and deceived. They have a right to know the truth about the companies they support with their hard-earned dollars, the Commanders, Mr. Snyder, the National Football League, and Roger Goodell deprived them of this right.
So I don't know if this investigation is going to actually put a whole lot of fear into Snyder. But this constellation of investigations is likely at least part of the pressure mounting on Dan Snyder and his wife, Tanya, to sell the team, which is what I want to focus on today, because in the week or so since they revealed that they'd hired Bank of America to vet owners, there's been a lot of little bits of news about who might be in the mix, which is what I want to talk about for our One of Us segment, which is the mystery future Commander's owner.
Sure.
Who's in the mix, and who's your fantasy candidate for the mix?
Well, there are only so many people who can buy an NFL franchise. They're the most expensive sports franchises on the planet Earth. And this team that Dan Snyder purchased just before the turn of the century cost him about $800 million. And now it is valued at $5.6 billion and could sell for upwards of $7 billion. So even in Washington, D.C., the world's capital, you're hard-pressed to walk down the street and bump into somebody with a checkbook who can buy this team. There are three people locally who can do it. One we know is for certain is Jeff Bezos, the owner of Amazon, one of the richest men in the world, the owner of the Washington Post, where I collect a paycheck. So he can do it. His name's been mentioned. And the other two people locally who could do it would be Ted Leonsis, who already owns the basketball franchises in this city, as well as the Washington Capitals hockey team. And then probably David Rubenstein, who, interestingly enough, owns the Magna Carta and is a billionaire a few times over.
What do you think is more expensive, the Magna Carta or the Commanders?
I would say that... I would say that the Magna Carta is better kept than the Commanders. we'll leave it at that, right? And of course, he has been said to have an interest in buying the Washington Nationals, who are up for sale in concert with Ted Leonsis. So those are the three people locally who have the ability to just buy the team. And of those three multi-billionaires, I would prefer Jeff Bezos. He has the most money. His ownership of the Washington Post has been, as best I can tell, completely hands-off. And he writes checks for the human capital that make it possible for the Washington Post to be one of the finest news gathering dissemination organizations on the planet. And I would assume that he would approach sports like that. Ted Leonsis has got his own thing already. You know, make the Caps a championship team again. Make the Wizards a championship contender again. Make the Mystics a championship team again. He's got that on his plate. I don't think he needs anything more. And David Rubenstein, he's a Duke guy. He's done so much to take care of our historical infrastructure in this town. I think he'd be a fine owner. But Bezos would be my number one pick.
Why is Bezos apparently being joined in his bid by Jay-Z and Matthew McConaughey? Doesn't he have the scratch to do it himself?
Yeah, I mean, he does, but I think he might just be lured by stardom that mm-hmm. wants to be involved. You know, Jay-Z already has the ear of Roger Goodell, the NFL commissioner. And has been involved in sports ownership before, most notably, you know, with the Brooklyn Nets and his ownership of the Barclays Center. Although I would say, you know, I'm not a champion for Jay-Z. I don't like the deal that built the Barclays Center and displaced so many working class people in that neighborhood, of which he and Beyonce played a role. And he doesn't have any connection to Washington, D.C., so I don't champion his ownership. Matthew McConaughey, he's just he's a Texan who's a fan of the team, which makes no sense. I don't know, maybe he's going to play bongos at some halftime or something. So I'm not attracted to him. But, you know, there are a number of more interesting D.C. connected, very well-heeled entertainment people who I think would be more attractive than Jay-Z or Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah, man, I wish Snyder had turned out to be a better advertisement for like local guy who's grew up with the team.
He never should have had the team. The only reason that we are in this situation is because Jack Kent Cooke, who could have just turned it over to one of his sons, refused to do so and put the team up for sale. And mm-hmm. this was the deal that came along that Snyder's deal that came along that seemed like a good thing at the time, but. Obviously, it's almost the worst thing that's ever happened to this team.
I've also seen stuff about out-of-town owners, like people who just sort of seem to collect sports teams. How would you feel about it being someone with that kind of profile?
I think that Washington, D.C. is big enough, and this franchise was golden enough to have local ownership. I'm born and reared in Washington, D.C. In a family that had season tickets to see this team play before I was born. My father grew up in Leroy Park in the shadow of Griffith Stadium, where the team originally played. My only memory of this team is local ownership. The racist George Preston Marshall, who brought the team down here from Boston, Jack Kent Cooke, and now Dan Snyder. So I've been accustomed to local ownership. And I think, you know, I just think that local ownership is better for a sports team than having someone outside the community running the show. That's not to say it can't be done.
Yeah,
it can be done. And, you know, there's some people who are looking at the Washington Nationals right now who are not from here or have any particular connection to here. But selfishly, I would prefer local ownership.
You know, I think whoever gets it is going to have such a nice honeymoon.
absolutely.
And that's actually a relevant thing, because their first order of priority, I assume, is going to be to get a stadium built.
Right. And Dan Snyder turned into such a despicable character that nobody around here felt that they could muster the political might to convince their community to stick more money in his pocket. And so that is a huge stumbling block. And as we know, the lease on the crumbling FedEx facility out in Largo, Maryland, runs out in just a few years. So the clock is really, really ticking right now.
Oh boy, that the team put out a statement after Carl Racine said he was going to have a statement. This statement was so ugly. Oh. It's not the kind of statement I think you would make if you have any hope of getting the taxpayers to build you a stadium.
Oh, absolutely not. It was a pile of bovine manure, if ever there was one. I read that. And to have the timidity to drag Brian Robinson's name and shooting into this was just beyond the pale.
For those of you who didn't read it, what it said was basically, look, one of our players got shot in D.C. and D.C. has out of control violence, and it's an out of control crime place. And doesn't the city attorney general have better things to do? Which, you know, legally, no, he doesn't actually, because he doesn't prosecute crime. But also was not the kind of statement a true blue son of the city will give. It sounded like he doesn't much like the place.
No, exactly.
Hey, DC. One of the reasons hosting this show is so important to me is this statistic from the U.S. Surgeon General. Ready for it? The percentage of Americans who report feeling very attached to their community is only 16%. Now, there's a lot of ways to look at that number, which, by the way, is pre-pandemic data. But here's how I'm thinking about it. CityCast DC is something that we're building to make it easier for you to feel attached to this community. I don't want anyone to feel lonely or bored here in DC. I want you to know how you can help make this city more fun and more livable, and where all the good local stuff is at. And if you think we're doing a good job, I'm asking if you'll become a member of CityCast DC today at membership.citycast.fm. You'll get exclusive perks like ad-free listening, event invites, and members-only guides. But most of all, you'll be part of a project dedicated to making the number of DC residents who feel attached to this community a heck of a lot higher than 16%. See you over at membership.citycast.fm, and thank you.
All right, so speaking of grapes, we're going to move on to a section about low-to-the-ground grapes. And I mean really, literally low-to-the-ground. There is a bill in the district to decriminalize sidewalk vending. This has been a deal, particularly in the neighborhood Columbia Heights, where vendors say they've been harassed by the police, subject to violence, et cetera, et cetera. Dan, you are a sidewalk man. You and I, maybe our first conversation was about what makes neighborhoods have more vibrant or less vibrant parks and sidewalks. What do you make of this?
So it's been really remarkable to see on 14th Street in Columbia Heights this really vibrant, lively, basically outdoor sidewalk market form over the past few years, right? In front of the mall where people will normally be going to Target and Best Buy and stuff. The challenge is it is pretty much unregulated, right? Anyone can come and set up a table. There can be some less savory activities going on. And also for someone trying to walk down the street, it can be really hard to navigate all of the different things that are going on, particularly if you're using a mobility device, a walker, a wheelchair, a stroller. And so there's sort of two things happening. You know, one is the district wants to decriminalize sidewalk vending so the people who are just trying to make a living don't feel intimidated or aren't being unfairly harassed for just trying to do their thing. And then also figuring out, you know, how should a sidewalk look in a place like Columbia Heights where there are lots of different parties with a claim to it?
Yeah, so I remember when I first covered city stuff, a restaurant would have to get a permit to have a sidewalk cafe. And people would say, you know, that is public property and we are turning it over to this private business. And that's terrible. And to me, it's like, you know, actually a neighborhood with a sidewalk cafe, that's kind of a nice thing. I enjoy that feeling, even if I'm not getting to sip a drink in that sidewalk cafe. On the other hand, you know, cities pass regulations on stores in order to protect consumers, to protect labor, to protect safety. You do have to get permits to sell different kinds of food, again, in the name of public safety. So having like, I don't know, I guess it's like a balance. On the one hand, I really like the idea of vibrant street life. On the other hand, it seems weird to have classes of people who are not subject to / protected by regulations.
Yeah, I think decriminalization has to come first. You know, a lot of these folks who run the sidewalk markets are people of color. They are immigrants. They are people who may not have historically had great experiences with police or with the government. And so first, I think you need to take that threat away, that just you existing on the sidewalk will get you a ticket or tossed in jail, and then start talking about, okay, how can we actually hold you accountable for using this public space? Because you're totally right. No one wants to walk on an empty, dead sidewalk, but we want to make sure these folks are being taken care of before we start telling them how they're going to do it.
All right. So there is a hearing about this on Wednesday at DC Council. Be there. And I think that's all the time we've got today. Dan and Kevin, thank you so much for coming and hanging out. Always awesome to have you guys here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for the invite.
Our lead producer is Priyanka Tilvey. Our producer is Julia Karen. Our newsletter writer is Kayla Cote Stemmerman. And our hosts are Bridget Todd and me, Michael Schaefer from Politico. Music is by Alex Roldan. If you enjoyed this show, please tell a friend, rate the show, leave us a review, and for heaven's sake, subscribe to our morning newsletter. We'll be back Monday morning with more news from around the city. Bye.